Jim.
What?
Well, in honor of Quadrophenia coming.
Jim and I are going to see Quadrophenia.
We're going to see it.
Since
I was able to get tickets.
And Neil Young.
Hours and hours. And Ray got Neil Young tickets this morning.
In 15 minutes. It was so
unbelievable.
So, we're in the first call.
I see a man without a problem. I see a country always smiling. I hear the music of a heartbeat. I walk in the people turning love.
Okay.
Let's see. The story is called Voices, Music for the Cosmic Ruin, the New Fiction. And this is the third part. That's an umbrella title for four stories. And this is the third of the four stories. And its subtitle is Silent Backward Tracings, November 95. Silent Backward Tracings is...
I don't know what it's from.
I think it's from Whitman. Yeah, I think it's from Whitman. It's one of his late, mellow, bummed, melancholy Whitman poems. I think it's Whitman. Anyway, so it begins with an epigraph from John Cougar Mellencamp, from a song called The Sweet Evening Breeze, which goes, "How redundant the future can be. These days of old are very, very ridiculous for me to see. When I think about the real gone stories and how time holds the winning hand, I can tell by the lines in their faces, and the young can't understand, that they look at me when they look at themselves." One. "Close upon the glit time of year, lit and warmly lonely, often in New England, a freezing time, virgin, deaf, Puritan, white, and yet softly pretty, sad. Sad in no way, in a way no other time of year is. Coldly visible breath, puffs of spent mortality, rapturous sentences, grasping blindly for the right word, thrilled by the spasm of the quest, thumped and thwarted by the elusive floating sparkle. This story, third of the quartet, deep in the hole, chronicles a quest to extend a mortal reach far enough back to grip something rhythmic, intense, and pretty, and to draw it along to these redundant later days. Were it possible to do this, perhaps a crowded highway of backward-reaching graphs would form. 'Tis not possible, of course. Only the hand of imagination is capable of mimicking it. Set that bonfire, baby, and fetch for you and me our favorite pairs of crotchless underwear, because we're going to entwine until we're but one bead of faceless sweat, ready to rain singly upon that rising fire and hiss ascendantly. Now a wisp of steam in pursuit of that sparkle, willing to travel as far back as must be, to coax, to fetch that something rhythmically pretty, residing in the closed, darkened palace of a go. 2. 'Twas so many days ago, don't know how many, that it was getting there, not there yet, but getting there. We'll know the sound when we finally hear it. It will be new. It will be ours. How long ago was that anyway? How many days? And what was this? What song was it when we first heard it, heard our sound? Probably one of them long hair numbers. Peace and love and bollocks for all, quipped Cecil Gray. Funny thing was that we had no audience when first it happened. We didn't have one for a long time after that too, smiles Greta Block. But there it was. What I trusted to find us, help us find, was found. Then Luna T named us, and life was briefly good. She said, you sound less like noisy children and more like musicians, recalls Ron Pascal. Beatles, that's where it began. In a way, that's always where it's been. There was a time when countless ears would keep an intent audit for the next Beatles. That's what I wanted us to be. The next Velvet Underground, too. The next Fleetwood Mac. The noisy children. Us. The new nobodies. And now? There's not even a we anymore. The dream is over. I just believe in me, says Stephanie Tormé sadly. Noisy children silent? Children grown old and scattered? Well, well, we'll just see now, won't we? 9. We drank on. We drank till neither of us could see or walk. This sounds like last night, Jim. We drank till sick and threw up loudly and painfully and washed up a bit and resumed drinking.
Yeah, we'd throw up.
My dream of the gray field intermixed with what shards of awakeness I retained when I found myself in Luna T's band room on stage, unable to play a note of my guitar. I was told later that I was discovered in a rubble of broken glass and smashed guitars. Jim was found in the old manager's office snoring peacefully, an empty bottle of whiskey held lovingly to his chest, rising and falling. You're right, Jim. I'm just not mellow. 10. I suppose I did a lot of drinking myself during that year. Yes, it's true. And what else? I played my guitar, happily not losing my ability like in those dreams. What I couldn't do with my guitar, of course, was pull the sound of my band from it. And that's in the end what I wanted. I wanted them with me on Lunatese Cafe's stage more than anything else. I suppose that was what was penetrating my thought. I suppose that what was penetrating my thoughts was that for the first time, I might not get them back, all of them. And did they believe in me anymore anyway? I was no longer the wonder boy arrived on the scene of four lost souls, able to bring them together and inspire from their depths artistic bloom. Not a one too much imagined or hoped was there. That's what I'd done. But I hadn't done much for any of them in a long time. Disappointment, that was it. They weren't lost anymore. Each had developed over the years during the increasingly long breaks Noisy Children took. Put simply, they could live without me. Not that they wanted to, but they could. Could I carry on alone if I had to? Probably not. I'd sit alone at the bar long into the weaker hours and reflect on just how empty my life would be. It would get weird. I'd find myself on Lunatee's darkened stage at 3 a.m., acoustic guitar in my hands, joint stereo blasting Beatles or REM or Smithereens or Velvet's LPs, and I'd be bombed enough to imagine my band was around me. Rodney and me exchanging riffs, tightening into one glorious sound before I'd let him carry on for me to one of his glorious leads. In my drunken trance, I heard him playing new leads, ones I'd never heard him do in our 15-year association. I'd press him with my shoulders or back, compelling him to get higher now. Stephanie's keyboard's pretty and inspired, herself looking at me critically as always, a look that stopped just short of desire, a hungry look, a demanding look, one demanding that I display and authenticate my manhood continuously, herself not one to be led by but a few. Greta's strumming her bass guitar, enjoying my company like in the old days, no disappointment in her eyes from recent days when I couldn't allow even her soft, benign intent to trespass my solitary scape. And Gray, balding fucking English drumming drink-sodden maniac. He bore my balls, demanding as well, but as roughly, as unforgiving of my second-rate efforts. I'd give him the lead vocals on the prettiest songs just to see what he'd do, how he'd preserve, how he'd maul. But it wasn't just this easy anymore. Tours, records, half-kept promises, all obscured how good we could be. The warm weather approached and I did nothing to get the group together. You're 35 today, you shagger. I remember when you were near half of that. I'm glad you do. I don't. Where did it all go, Americus? Have I really been sitting up my drum kit in that room in there watching you shake that ass of yours for 15 years? I suppose. Are we going to play again? I know that Pascal wants to, and Greta Bird. And Stephanie? That's where it breaks down, mate. I think our little incident at X's studio flipped her out, but good. Yeah. Of course, if she'd let me flip her on her back and make a visit to that tight arse of hers, she'd be back. Yeah. You gonna drink from your pitcher or buy it a dress?
It's just a table of papers.
Okay.
Well, I do not know sugars from silvers, reds from pickles. I know the obvious shape of maple seen from my porch. I know its greens. And I know that on the second day of a misshapen summer, the top leaves are turning from their green to salmon, turning on the second day with no heat to bear, turning on the day when clouds hang as low as December.
Misshapen summer.
This is a poem that is, it's called Blue Tinge a Second Time. And it's very strongly based on another poem by Charles Simic, simply called Late Blue Tinge. I don't have the original, I wish I had it with me to read to you guys, but I'll just let this stand on its own. What do you imagine when Charles Simic's poem when he was alive? Jesus, suspended a second time, hangs between a shopping list and a photo of dead ones. And instead of vinegar, salty urine and fragile kaleidoscopes rise to where he hangs, above the blue fire in the tenement. Breaking this chapel's calm, is a groan. We're Prozac, baby. The calm of the hushed cell returns. A chorus word. and as kaleidoscopes swirl about in the salted mist, the boy peers from the path, to peer at a picture, to catch a glimpse of the brothers.
Hmm.
Very good.
Thank you.
That was hallucinatory.
Yeah.
It was hallucinatory. I started to fade out later.
All right. I don't know how much stamina you guys have, so I'll read a few scenes, you guys just vote, go like that. Because I have a bit. I also know how much you're fans of the X-Files.
Well, is this an original episode you're reading here? Do they finally get it on and
really
fuck each other good?
No, yeah, two brothers-in-law. One of them said they should take off her top.
Yeah, that's his first comment.
That
one
never.
Well, I mean, it's like
Republicans sell it to Chris Carter. It's like, wrong.
See, they're not making that mistake. Like, they're not going to make that mistake in that show, having them go out with each other or anything.
It's a fantasy.
Unless they get
Diana Rigg
fantasy sequence
and Patrick McNee on the Avengers.
What?
Fantasy sequence?
How do you think about 16 characters?
He was describing what Paul prepared.
A fantasy sequence. That was appropriate.
You're right. They're not gonna.
No, because it's killed so many series.
Cheers. Perfect example.
You
can even say Master extent. It seems like after that point where Hawkeye and Margaret, it seems like it almost...
Yeah, that was one of
those. I don't know if it's...
No, I mean, you can argue it.
They couldn't do anything. That was the problem. I mean, they tried to resolve it in the course of the episode, and they never mentioned it again.
They had a couple of great episodes, even later on in this series, but still, I thought that after a certain point, they were kind of just cranking them out. Just like they did in Cheers. After a while, like,
yeah.
Okay.
One run after another.
You know, I don't know.
Any purpose.
I don't mean to diss MASH, I'm as big a fan as there is, but anyway, this is
an
excellent
episode.
She held on to the railing. Go ahead, Sean. Why do you think I sit here?
So that when the peg on your guitar flies out, it can go in any possible direction, therefore be completely lost without any hope of recovery.
I still think it went over.
But just think, Jim, it will always be here, because we could find it. No, broom is
over. I'm embarrassed, but I'll tell you what happened. I was walking into view just as it happened. I had my mouth open for some reason.
And rather than trying to get it out,
I got it.
You were so hungry, John.
It was really embarrassing. It flew right in.
Oh, man.
I got this. In a few days, I'll give it back to you, okay? I mean,
no, that's all right.
I didn't mean to revolt you.
No.
You're just too much, folks. So.
After the clients I work with, they were revolting. Go ahead.
The man sitting by the window glimpsed the glimmer of water through gaps in the clouds. The clouds were ripped and torn by wind, and they were thicker ahead. The jet appeared to be heading into a storm. Turning from the window, he reached down for his black leather briefcase. He unlocked it with a combination and a key, popping it open on his lap. The top document was labeled in large, bold letters. Outline for a cooperative effort by U.S. government and business for aid, investment, and economic development in Palestine. He frowned, flipping through the thick report, pausing once to examine a list of bank presidents and CEOs. He turned to the aide next to him. You know, without these names, this entire report would be meaningless. The other man nodded, and this whole trip a complete waste of taxpayer dollars. They both chuckled. The aide half-twisted in his seat to scan a few of the other faces aboard the jet. And they're all here, I said. Good thing, too, his boss agreed, taking another look out the window. I just hope this weather doesn't make for a longer trip. Or a wetter one, rejoined the aide. They shared another chuckle, but it felt a little forced. It'd be a horrible way to go, the first man murmured, mostly to himself. As part of a nervous habit, he twisted the gold ring in his finger, which bore a sapphire carved in the shape of a pyramid with an eye in the summit. His glance shifted from the ring to the digital readout on his watch. The time was 6:37 p.m. Below his feet, in the jet's cargo hold, lay a crate. In the crate was a plastic canister. In the canister, there was a complicated device made up of metal, wires, and plastic. It also contained a digital timing mechanism that read 6:37 p.m. The jet soared on over the fringe of the Atlantic. The twilight coast and towns to the north slowly began to recede. A large island lay off to the south.
The aircraft drew closer to a narrow strip of land stretched across its path and disappeared into the dark clouds. There was a bright flash and a sky-splitting boom. A whale in the ocean below turned lazily in the lapping waves. With one large eye, it saw fragments of metal spinning out of the sky. It drew breath and slid into the safe, cool depths.
I have one problem with that.
Oh, go ahead.
It's not in the ocean, or in the Mediterranean. There are no whales there.
This is the Atlantic. There are whales in the Atlantic.
In the Atlantic, yeah.
This is the Atlantic.
But the plane exploded.
Oh, I changed it. I'm not going to make it.
Oh, okay. This is not a verbatim.
Yeah, no, I'm changing it a little.
Okay, all right, okay.
Good point. No, yeah. Fair enough.
I wasn't sure what you were doing exactly.
No, because if I did it verbatim, they would never be able to do it as a story.
Right, okay.
I'm already turning close as it is. I'm trying to...
That's true.
Anyway, Washington, D.C., Friday night, 8 p.m. Fox Mulder, the FBI's problem child, sat hunched over a TV dinner, faced with one of the toughest decisions of his career.
Never seen any of the TV.
Sampling the mashed potato, he mulled it over. The phone rang then, and Mulder picked up. Hello? Mulder, it's me. In Mulder's universe, me with his partner and most trusted friend, Dana Scully, smiled. Scully, I'm glad you called. I've got sort of a dilemma here, and maybe you can help. I'll try. What is it? Well, there's a special Friday night airing of The Simpsons on right now, and I'm torn. It's on opposite the alien autopsy video. Mulder grunted appreciatively. No, but you're on the right track. The sci-fi channel's been running Darren McGavin's Night Stalker series every Friday at 8, and tonight it's the UFO episode.
That's very appropriate.
That's an actual episode. I'm not crazy. Oh, okay.
I remember that episode, yeah.
Should I go on? Is it okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Excuse my sideline comments.
Oh, no, I appreciate it, actually. I don't know. Dana Scully pushed the paperwork away from her. A copy of the FAA's preliminary report on the plane crash had taken quite a while to read. As usual, her partner left the unexciting aspects of researching the case to her. Scully didn't mind. Given a choice, she would always choose the facts, dry and mundane as they might be. She sipped her coffee, reviewing the notes she had typed into the laptop on the table before her. Facts were what she liked, but there weren't enough here to decisively close the case. So I reached for the phone and dialed the number for Mulder's cell phone. Mulder, I have the FAA's preliminary report, and I thought you might want to hear what I've learned. Mulder was turning off the highway onto an exit ramp as he asked, "What have you got for me, Scully?" "Not much, I'm afraid. The pilot reported flying into a storm, put the jet to a climb to get above the squall. The FAA first suspected this is when a wind shear effect had brought down the jet. Wind shear has not been ruled out, but the recent recovery of scorched wreckage associated with a cargo hold has led to the development of alternative theory. An explosion," Mulder prompted, pulling into a parking lot. "Yes. It was a military jet. Besides its passengers, it was also carrying supplies for the UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon. Ammo? Enough to blow up a jet. If lightning struck the aircraft..." "Wait a minute, Scully. Aren't the detonators for heavy explosives stored separately during transport?" "Yes, but a lightning strike may serve as a detonating charge." Mulder's brow was furrowed as he steered his car into his face. "What would UN peacekeepers be doing with that kind of firepower? I thought those guys were supposed to be lightly armed." "You're forgetting the recent trouble with Hezbollah. The military has informed the FAA that munitions intended to enhance the UN force were aboard the jet." "Fine. Now what about the black box? Has that been recovered yet?" "There is no black box. Military aircraft are not required to carry them, and this one didn't have one." Mulder's mouth fell open. "What? Isn't this the same jet CNN says the vice president had flown out only a week before the accident?" "Yes, Mulder, is, but it was not equipped with a black box." Mulder turned off the engine. "Have they found any of those so-called peacekeeping explosives?" "Not yet." Scully paused and asked, "How did your visit with your mother go?" Mulder got out of the car, locked it. "Tell you in a minute. I'm in the hotel parking lot. I'll be right up." Scully was staring out the window of the rental car as it meandered toward the edge of Chatham, Massachusetts. Mulder had driven the entire way from an island and had been almost silent throughout the trip. She had leafed through the file as it stood so far, going over facts she already knew. Harder had not so much as glanced at her. She next just scribbled down on a notepad the case's more interesting facts, even the beginnings of what she thought might go into her final report. Mulder paid her not the slightest heed. She had turned on the radio, finding National Public Radio, and listening to classical music. This also had met with no response. Finally becoming bored with both Mulder and the case, she had just taken to staring out the window and admiring the scenery. "It's really beautiful," Scully commented, unintentionally speaking her thought aloud. "I know," Mulder said absently. Scully raised an eyebrow and eyed her partner. "I think those are the first words you've spoken since we crossed the bridge at Buzzard's Bay." "Sorry, I guess I've just been thinking." "About the case?" No, about being a kid out here, a long time ago. Oh, I wonder, Scully, a little puzzled. I thought you spent your summers at that place in Rhode Island. Mulder smiled a little, glancing at her. Pontchartrain? Scully, come on. Rhode Island's a small state. We took lots of trips to Connecticut, Boston, out here to the Cape. A lot of my childhood spent in California, where out-of-state places are a little hard to get to. I suppose it's conditioned by thinking somewhat. Really? You mean you never took a trip to a wild hotspot like Tijuana or Vegas, or even to the Grand Canyon? The Grand Canyon. She wondered if he was deliberately teasing her. So what was it like growing up in this area? Nice, most of the time. He pointed. Well, here we are, Monomoy Island. You can see the sea on both sides. Scully saw that the finger of land they were on was wide enough for the road and not much else. People standing outside cars parked on the roadside watched seals basking on the beach. Why do they call it an island? This is a peninsula. Mulder shrugged, noting, accidents happen in strange places. Chappaquiddick Island is a peninsula, but you don't hear the Kennedys complaining. Scully gave Mulder a skeptical look. He grinned. There were more cars up ahead, parked on both sides of the road. The people that had come in these cars apparently had no interest in the SEALs. They were shouting and shoving, along with at least one television camera crew, pressing up against a military roadblock. Traffic had come almost to a dead stop. Mulder pulled off to the left side of the road, turned off the engine. He and Scully got out. Holding up his badge, saying, FBI, let us through, Mulder led the way through the crowd. MPs stood guard all on the barricade. Two manned the lift gate that had been placed across the road. Gathered before the gate, along with the camera crew and a few curious tourists, was a group of 30 or 40 protesters carrying bulging garbage bags and signs bearing slogans such as, the real crisis in the air, poisoned gulls everywhere. A young woman at the head of the group was angrily addressing an Air Force officer who was shaking his head and pointing back toward Chatham. You have no right to keep people out of a national park, and you have no right to poison the gulls here. The government is breaking the law. The military is not poisoning any seagulls, responded the officer, a tall, lean, ruggedly handsome man. This land is administered by the federal government, which has closed off the area in order to conduct an accident investigation. I will now acquaint you with the law. Attempts to enter this area by unauthorized personnel will be met with their forcible removal. Other steps will be taken as necessary. Obstructing the road with parked vehicles will result in their forcible removal. Again, other steps will be taken as necessary. I am bound by the Constitution of the United States to enforce these orders. If you do not remove yourselves and your vehicles, or take appropriate action. You have, he paused to check his watch, 10 minutes. What can I do for you? The final remark was directed to two newcomers, though perhaps more towards Scully, where his eyes lingered as he surveyed the pair. I'm Agent Mulder, this is Agent Scully. We're with the FBI and are here to take a look at the crash site. The slim blonde woman who had accused the government of lawbreaking grabbed Mulder's arm. What you should be investigating is the cold-blooded murder of thousands of great black-backed gulls and herring gulls in a national wildlife refuge. What do you mean? The officer took a breath, blew out his cheeks, and looked up at the sky. The woman eagerly launched into her explanation. The government is giving the gulls DRC 1339 to drastically reduce their numbers. Starting in 1946, they gave irradiated breakfast cereal to 49 retarded boys at the federal state school in Waltham, Massachusetts. For 10 years, all 49 died. There's no difference. You know what they called the people they exposed to the first nuclear test explosions? Low-use population. Here they're killing low-use gulls. Mulder saw the earnest passion in her face and nodded. You're right, we'll look into it. As they moved past the barricade, Mulder noted the officer's name in his uniform and asked, are you in charge of the military presence here, Colonel Morgan? I am. Is what that woman was saying true? The colonel snorted and shook his head. That woman was Eve Alcott. I'm in charge of the military presence. She's in charge of the environmentalist presence. Funny thing is, the EPA has mandated the protection of another bird species threatened by the gulls. Which is why the government is poisoning the gulls, Mulder supplied. You got it. And if the government hadn't stepped in, Eve Alcott and her friends would be here protesting the extinction of protected species. Colonel shrugged. No win scenario. Damned if you do, damned if you don't, observed Scully. What was in the plastic bags? Tuna and charcoal filter sandwiches, replied Colonel Morgan, drawing a nod from Scully and a confused look from Mulder. And here we are. It's a long walk to Monomoy Point. While they had been walking, the colonel had led them over to his Jeep. He got in behind the wheel, motioning for them to get in. Getting in beside Colonel Morgan, Mulder asked, so what has the salvage operation turned up so far, Colonel? Most of the jet and the bodies, the colonel replied, turning to check that Scully was also in, then putting the Jeep in gear. Is that it? Colonel Morgan turned to squint at Mulder. That's pretty good when most of it had to be pulled out of the ocean. But sir, Scully interjected, leaning forward, hasn't the Air Force Accident Investigation Team found evidence of an explosion? Yeah, but what does that mean? That could have happened after wind shear brought down the aircraft, the fuel tanks could have ruptured, there might have been electrical fire. If lightning hit the jet, there's your explosion. Hell, if you want wildest speculation, then blame it on the damn UFO. UFO? Mulder asked softly, giving a colonel a quizzical look. On the night of the crash, Sloy said, intervening again, there were a few reports of unusual lights seen in the sky of residents on the Cape and on Nantucket. There is a very real possibility that lightning effects and the explosion of the jet itself are responsible for these reports. Holder's expression had changed from quizzical to ironic. Why didn't you tell me about the UFO reports, Scully? The dubiousness of the reports, given the lightning and explosion, for one thing, Scully answered. I also thought it'd be better to look into the hard facts first before chasing down UFO sightings that may not even be UFO sightings. But you were planning to tell me, Holder persisted. Yes, Scully said, looking away, allowing herself to smile a little and adding quietly, eventually.